Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. The second and third segment today, I am pleased to have my conversation with James Corbett from the Corbett Report. And of course, that was previously recorded Wednesday evening. And I just enjoy those 40 minutes with him so much when we do that every other week. And he's so informative and so insightful. And we got a great two segments for you today. So I'm live right now, and it is Friday, October 19th, 2018. You know, it was 31 years ago today, and I'll get to the market report in just a moment. It was 31 years ago today, Black Monday occurred. It was October 19th, 1987. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost almost 22% in a single day. And, of course, that event had marked the beginning of a global stock market decline. And, of course, Black Monday became one of the most notorious days in financial history. By the end of the month, most of the major exchanges had dropped more than 20%. And, you know, they say that the cause of this massive stock market drop can't be attributed to any single news event. There was no major news event that was released the weekend that preceded the crash. There's a lot of theories out there, but it was the mass panic that causes these crashes to escalate. And, of course, this is why confidence is so important. This is why there is never any warnings. They don't want you to panic. They don't want you to take care of yourselves and preserve your purchasing power. They don't want you to panic. So, you know, since Black Monday happened, we know there's been a lot of protective mechanisms that were built into the markets to prevent panic selling. Trading curbs, circuit breakers, but with this high-frequency trading algorithms that's done by these supercomputers, you can have massive volume moves in just milliseconds. And of course, this is what's extremely, hey, it's all fine and dandy when it's going to the upside. But once it breaks to the downside, it's a different story. And certainly the volatility is something where I don't think too many people can, say everything is going to be okay, because, you know, those when it reverses, those reverses get smaller and smaller. And of course, I think everyone knows or more familiar with the PPT. Of course, the PPT is the Plunge Protection Team. And it was created by President Reagan, but it was coined, the Plunge Protection Team, only in 1997. And of course, we understand that when markets move, that this team comes in and they execute trades on different exchanges and manipulate the markets when they head down. They want to stem the bleeding. And so it was in 1989 that President Reagan created the President's Working Group on Financial Markets. And of course, after the two stressful 1987 and 1989. And of course, this group acted as an advisory group on the markets for the president and regulators. But of course, this group is capable of rigging the market in turbulent times. And it's just that simple. And so we got a little more to talk about that. And there's actually examples, you know, during the 2007 and 2008 financial crisis, there were telephone calls between Hank Paulson, who was the Treasury Secretary then, and Wall Street. Actors were recorded on days when the stock market was tanking and a downward spiral required reversal. And so we've seen now not just the United States do this, but also the, you know, Japan, China. So they all do it. And so, again, you have to get ahead of them because eventually the markets will overtake and all of their rigging will won't seem to matter. Let's go ahead and get to the market report today. They do the same to the downside with gold and silver, the precious metals, because that they are the little bird in the canary. You know, when they're going up and they're moving, you know, there's usually something happening on the other side that's not doing so well in the paper market. So they do keep these numbers low to prevent any types of panic, because gold and silver is that bird in the canary. Oh, is the canary in the mine, I should say. Gold today was up 80 cents at $1,227. Silver was up 6 cents at $14.71. Platinum was up 5 at $835. Palladium was up 9 at $1,083. The USDX today was a little weaker, 0.21 at $95.75. Crude oil was up 65 cents at 69.30. And the paper markets today, they were kind of all over the page, both negative, positive. Some were up, some were down. The Dow was up 64 points today at 25,444. The NASDAQ was down almost a half a percent, 7,449, down 36 points. The S&P basically unchanged, down 1 at 2,767. The 10-year yield popped big, 3.20%, and that was up 0.02. Foreign and Asian markets were basically, you know, very little movement in there. Extreme fear has moved up to 15, so again, take the panic and the fear away. And most people make the most money in those panic when the markets are going down. Let's see what I wanted. Yeah, again, there's so much of the same news that's happening. And so I came across, maybe it's going to be a little bit of a different, I have some financial news. Let me see if I can find this here. The Treasury Department today outlined some rules for those who are seeking to finance development in underserved regions in exchange for significant tax breaks. And the opportunity zones come with several tax advantages. Capital gains are placed in a certified opportunity zone fund, and it will not be taxed through the end of 2026 or when the investment is sold, whichever comes first. Now, this is opened, of course, to individuals, corporations, businesses, REITs, and estates, and trusts. So, you know, that all sounds fine and dandy, and it certainly can create this. They outlined the rules today. The Treasury Department, the proposed guidance would govern investments in so-called opportunity zones across the country that were created under the sweeping new Republican tax law. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin estimated as much as $100 billion in private capital could be funneled into those areas. With the idea that this would give Americans the opportunity to take advantage. This incentive is going to foster economic revitalization and promote sustainable economic growth, of course, which was a major goal of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And this was said by Mnuchin. And what's also interesting is that any gains from the funds are permanently shielded from taxes if the investment has been held for 10 years. So if you hold the investment for 10 years, there's never any taxes on that. In addition, the initial investment will be discounted by up to 15% for tax purposes after 7 years. So again, ladies and gentlemen, those of us little individuals who don't have billions of dollars to invest in going into these opportunity zones, guess who's going to be funding and subsidizing? Now, I can look at it both ways. I can look at that this is a great thing. They can go into some of these poor areas and, you know, build them, creates jobs. And a lot of these poor areas, they're certainly not going to hire the people in the areas. They're going to be bringing people in from outside. Are they going to use, how are they going to get these properties into these communities? And what's interesting is, let me see if I can find this. The states have designated more than 8,700 census tracts as opportunity zones, including nearly all of Puerto Rico. The day they had the hurricane, the day Puerto Rico was destroyed, I said what's going to happen is you're going to have all these multinational corporations going in there, putting up their hotels. And it's great for the people who work there. They'll be able to be maids and waiters and things like that. So, but they'll come in and they'll take advantage and get all this beachfront property. So nearly all of Puerto Rico will have been designated as an opportunity zone. The average poverty rate in the zones is 32%. And of course, compared with the national average of 17%. So they're going into the poorest areas. What I want to know is, what are they going to do with the people in the poorest areas? They're just going to take over their properties. I don't know how it's worked, because further along, one part of this Mnuchin, well, it wasn't Mnuchin, it was a senior treasury official, said, we felt it was important to issue the core guidance now that's needed to get the funds up and operating and not wait until we have every question answered. So it's just like, okay, let's just get this thing going, and hey, you know, we'll just deal with it as we go along. We don't want everybody to really know the fine details. You know, again, the big print giveth and the little print taketh away, and they don't want us to know what, how it really is going to impact. Now, is this infrastructure? Is it helping roads? Is it going to help roads? Is it going to help our power? Is it going to help our water systems? Is it going to help our bridges? Is it going to help our here we get to subsidize this, and how is it helping airports and everything else? So is this a good thing? I can't say it's a bad thing, but I think it's, I don't think it's as good as what it sounds. So we'll be following this here throughout. Maybe when they finally want to answer some questions, or when they have the answers to the questions, we'll bring them to you. That was really pretty much it. Of course, don't forget your lottery tickets. It's almost $1 billion, if it isn't over $1 billion by the time the Mega Millions jackpot. So we don't want to miss that. So make sure you at least go out and buy one. You can't win if you don't play. So go out and get your lottery ticket. That should be a little fun. And remember who you're going to buy your gold from. If you win that, you're going to call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. I found this fascinating. China is going to launch an artificial moon to light up the night skies. Chinese scientists are planning to launch an artificial moon into orbit by 2020 to illuminate city streets after dark. Scientists are hoping to hang the man-made moon above the city of Chengdu, the capital of China's southwestern Sichuan province. And this is according to a report in the Chinese state media. You want to talk about fake news, but anyway, we'll continue with this because it really is interesting if it is true. The imitation celestial body is essentially an illuminated satellite, and it's going to bear a reflective coating to cast sunlight back to Earth, where it will supplement street lights at night. Scientists estimated that it could be 8 times more luminous than the actual original moon. And it's also going to orbit much closer to Earth, about 310 miles away, compared to the moon's 236,000 miles. But it wouldn't light up the entire night sky. Its expected brightness in the eyes of humans is around 1/5 of normal street lights. So they estimated that the new moons, and now this is plural, so they're meaning to put more than one up, could have the city of around 1.2 2 billion yuan, which is $173 million, in electricity costs annually. So they're looking to save the city $173 million in electricity costs annually. And it could even assist first responders during blackouts and natural disasters. So if the project proves successful, it could be joined by 3 more additions to the night sky in 2022. He says, but more testing needs to be done. The scientist says that to ensure the plan is viable and will not have a detrimental effect on the natural environment. He says, we will only conduct our tests in an uninhabited desert, so our light beams will not interfere with any people on Earth or Earth-based space observation equipment. And actually, China's space goals are not unprecedented. In the 90s, Russia experimented with using an orbital mirror to reflect sunlight on some of its sun-deprived northern cities. And we can't forget that we have Project, what is that called? Project Blue Beam. I can't ever remember that name. So it's not quite the same, but it's the same as experimenting with satellites and out in the orbit and so forth. But Russia abandoned their experiment back in 1999 after the mirror failed to unfold and was incinerated in the atmosphere. You also had in January, you had an American rocket lab launch an artificial star into space, scientists criticized the Humanity Star as the reflective mini-satellite was dubbed for contributing to artificial light pollution and cluttering in Earth's orbit. And I guess I'm just also going to have to say, maybe global warming, ladies and gentlemen, and I say that in jest. And we'll be talking a little bit about global warming with James Corbett here in just a few minutes. I got another minute left of this segment, and I wanted to talk about daylight saving time. It's actually November 4th on Sunday, and it seems like California is putting it up to vote to do away with it, and if it passes, it's something that it might go across this nation with other states. And I learned a lot of things about the DST, the how it started, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that, but I don't think we'll get to it here in the next 30 seconds. So in California, it's Proposition 7. It's going to be voted on next month, which would actually repeal California's Daylight Saving Time Act. And so I guess we'll have to fall backwards or spring forward until it becomes effective. But I always thought it came up into the Depression, and that's not really the case. And I'll bring you the history of that perhaps when we get closer to November 4th. Please stay with us, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'll be back with James Corbett in just a few minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CommonSenseTalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm pleased to share the next 40 minutes with James Corbett, the founder of the Corbett Report, that he started in 2007, and he became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster in 2012, and the International Forecaster was originally founded by our good friend Robert Chapman. And I do encourage each and every one of you to visit James' website at thecorbettreport.com and also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Well, hello, James.
Well, hello, Melody. It's good to see you once again. Glad to be here.
Oh, and we always appreciate you being here. I know the listeners do enjoy the time that you give to us in our little chat. And usually I begin asking you if there's anything in particular on your mind that you'd like to share with the listeners. But tonight I'm going to ask you first what you think about Canada legalizing recreational marijuana.
I don't have a personal stake in this game because I'm neither in Canada nor a pot smoker, but I think the idea of less government regulation over regular substances that can grow in the ground and what people choose to do with their own bodies is in principle a good thing. There's a lot of different avenues that this can go down, including the GMO marijuana route that I have actually talked about before on my program with guest Ellen Brown, so people can dig into my archives about that. So there are some bad ways that this can go, but I think the general principle that a literal weed that grows in the ground everywhere should be made illegal and that people shouldn't be able to have it in their possession is a bad thing. So the elimination of those types of regulations is a good thing, but there's a lot of caveats that come with that.
Well, you know, you're right. It was described by the CEO of Cronos, I believe that's the correct pronunciation of that. He described it as a watershed moment for the industry. He says there's going to be more interest in legalizing marijuana worldwide, and you're having billions of dollars that are coming into these Canadian companies, the big pharmaceutical companies that might want to invest. You have Coca-Cola, you have, you know, so there is a lot of money to be made.
Well, actually, it's interesting. I'll parallel this to another development that's been on my mind lately, which is about the IMF's most recent World Economic Outlook, which is their annual report that they just released. And they specifically address cryptocurrencies in that. And they're talking about basically, there's some promising things with regards to this new financial technology that's coming online, but there's some worrying things too. So the answer, of course, as we would expect from the IMF, is we need more regulatory oversight. We need more international coordination of regulations so that we don't get some, you know, mishmash of different rules in different places, because of course this financial technology is now international, so we can't control it. And basically we need the banks to come in and regulate and administer these, you know, blockchains and new technologies, which of course is ridiculous. I mean, to anyone who knows what this technology is, what it represents, let alone the founding, the ethos of it that was laid out in the Bitcoin white paper, for example, explicitly saying this is to counter the central bank controlled monetary supply, the fiat money, the banks that are part of that regulatory structure. This is to counter that. Well, of course, now the IMF is coming along and trying to put that under the same umbrella. And here we go with financial technologies, the blockchain and Bitcoin and things like this, it is fundamentally at its base, it is about decentralization. They're trying to take it in a centralization route. In the same way, marijuana is fundamentally one of the most abundant, prolific things. It'll grow anywhere. It'll grow at any time. It's a weed. It'll literally grow all over the place, but they're going to try to if they can, they're going to try to limit that market and restrict it and make sure that it's, you know, the designer weed from Coca-Cola or whatever is what everyone will be smoking or ingesting in other ways. And that's, I mean, again, it goes 100% against the foundation of what this thing is, but this is the way that the corporate governmental overlay structure tries to come in and basically make profit out of what should be abundance.
Very good. Now, excuse me, now the big question is the Khashoggi, if I pronounce that correctly. Khashoggi? I'm not quite sure how.
Yeah.
Khashoggi? From the death of Jamal Khashoggi. The New York Times says that it's confirmed independently that at least 9 of 15 suspects identified by Turkish authorities in the disappearance of him worked for the Saudi security services, military, or other government ministries. He's been known to many dark secrets about the U.S. and Saudi intel collusion, primarily related to the 9/11 terror incidents. So, I mean, the list goes on with his associations, in that area, in that realm of the kingdom. And I just saw prior to coming, I don't know if this is anything, but I just saw, if I can bring it up here on my computer, that the headline read, let me bring it up here, the kingdom transfers $100 million to the U.S. On the day of Pompeo's visit to discuss missing journalists. That was from the Chicago Tribune that I'm reading from this report. So will we ever know? And what do you think is what's your take on what's going on with this incident, and how do you think this outcome will shape the world order, if at all?
Yeah, well, that last point remains to be seen, but it is significant in some way, and I'll have to put in the caveat here that I was on hiatus for the past week, so I wasn't following this story as it was developing, but I do know that this Saudi journalist, who apparently was murdered, and presumably or allegedly by Saudi Arabia, is the nephew of Adnan Khashoggi, which might ring a bell to some people in the 9/11 truth movement. He was a billionaire arms dealer, had connections into Osama bin Laden, and also was responsible for funding and hosting some of the early 9/11 truth conferences. Very strange connections going on there with Khashoggi. And this, I think, ties into the stew that is the Saudi royals and the Saudi business world and the Al-Qaeda terrorists and their connections into the intel world and their connections back to the Bush administration. All of this is floating around. And as you say, we have underlying all of this the specter of the, you know, multi-billion dollar arms deal that the Trump administration has already signed with Saudi Arabia and the hundreds of millions that are being transferred even as we speak as part of that. So there's a lot of business and political connections underlying this story. And that's why a story like this blows up. It's not like, oh, suddenly human rights concerns with regards to the Saudi royal family is a big deal now. I mean, no, of course, this is a drop in the bucket considering all of the stuff that goes on in Saudi Arabia every single day. But now it's becoming a big mainstream media issue, which is interesting to me because it shows that there is clearly some kind of political gambit, some kind of deep state gambit that's going on with regards to this story. And I'm not sure what the end goal is here. It seems, at least on the surface level, that the Trump administration wants status quo business as usual with the Saudi royal family. They don't want anything to disrupt that and to disrupt the major arms deals and all the other winks and nods that go on behind the scenes. But it looks like that is, there's some kind of monkey wrench being thrown into that by some or other element of the deep state. So it's very interesting, and I'm going to have to start digging into it a lot more before I start pronouncing on it. But clearly this isn't just, you know, the mainstream media suddenly discovering, oh, my God, there's problems with regards to Saudi Arabia.
Well, you know, it is really kind of fascinating, and it is really interesting. And, you know, you have the Washington Post that's owned by Jeff Bezos. They really haven't said anything about this guy. You know, he hasn't, I haven't seen any statement from him at all, you know, about his murder. And
let's just make that explicit for people who don't know. Of course, Bezos, owner of Amazon and now owner of Washington Post, Democracy Dies in Darkness, who also several years ago had a $600 million contract with the CIA to provide cloud computing services, and is now in the running to provide this new JEDI cloud computing service for the Department of Defense, this multi-billion-dollar, multi-year contract that the DOD is looking to hand out to one or a handful of lucky Silicon Valley partners. And Microsoft employees have started an internal mutiny, basically saying we shouldn't be going down this route, we shouldn't be cooperating with the Department of Defense on a project like this. Google has already pulled out of their potential participation in this cloud computing project, and when they did so, Jeff Bezos, Amazon, Washington Post, came out to say, oh, Google shouldn't be playing politics like this, and we need to support the Pentagon, and blah, blah, blah. So, of course, Amazon is still very much in the running for that multi-billion dollar Pentagon contract. And, interestingly enough, about 24 hours after Bezos came out excoriating Google for daring to think about pulling out of this DOD contracting bid, guess what happens? YouTube goes down worldwide for 30 minutes. I mean, one of the largest websites on the planet with obvious, not just multiple redundancy content distribution networks all over the world, but the most, you know, sophisticated, laid out content distribution network in existence goes down for 30 minutes. And I haven't checked today, but I have yet to see an explanation for what happened. Oh, yeah, YouTube just went down for half an hour. I don't know. There's clearly some shenanigans going on, and I wonder if it's related to that.
Yeah, but how could Google take the Pentagon contract and be involved in that when they do their contracts with China? I mean, but I guess they all do it, so I guess...
Yeah, you know. Well, different rules for different countries, of course, yeah. Which, again, goes exactly against the idea of what the Internet is, which is a decentralized network that any point on any node should be able to connect to any other node, and that's the idea of what this actually is at a technological level and a philosophical level. But, again, the governments and the regulators try to come in and impose their controls on it and limit it so that it becomes almost meaningless. I mean, what is the Internet if all we get is these walled gardens of nationally controlled internets that will be dictated by the rules of whatever, you know, oligarchy it presumes itself to be in control of any given nation.
But it's not going to change. I mean, it's just going to continue to... I mean, I don't see it, you know, actually being decentralized any more than what it is.
It should be.
It should be, but it's not going to be.
Well, anything that is properly corresponding to the internet protocols will just relay data in the way that it should. But then you get, you know, the Chinese government spending however many billions of dollars it's spent to construct its firewall to make sure that it can control what goes in and out of the internet of that country, which is, again, it's ridiculous. And you have to go through incredible hoops, jump through all sorts of technological hurdles to make something like that happen. And even then, it can be defeated by a VPN, which everyone in China knows, but you're not allowed to say, obviously, out in public. And I've experienced this myself out on a trip with GRTV reporting in Korea a couple of years ago about the 60th anniversary of the armistice, and they're with some Chinese journalists who, of course, off the record and away from their handlers, will say, yeah, of course, you just use a VPN and we can, you know, watch YouTube or whatever. But you can't dare to say that openly and in public. So again, you can spend bajillions of dollars trying to make the internet not be what it is, but it can be easily circumvented if you know what you're doing and are willing to risk the criminal penalties that will come with that.
I just want to touch one more thing back to the reporter Jamal Khashoggi. And President Trump is, here we go again with, you know, you're guilty until proven innocent. He doesn't like that. We just went through that with Justice Kavanaugh, and he was innocent all the way. And I also read where, you know, he talks about the strong relationship with the Saudi family, a strong ally. But yet he denounces the European allies that we've had for so long and so forth. Is he making a mistake placing such a strong relationship with the Saudis? I mean, I get the connection with Jared Kushner, Israel, and, you know, everything else that's going on. But it seems like, and maybe it's just, maybe at the moment it seems that this relationship is not going to be broken with the Saudis.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just means mistake from what perspective? Whose perspective? I mean, the general interest of the United States of America as some sort of general entity, or the interest of Trump and his family, or the interest of the business connections that have a lot to profit from this, or the intelligence connections.
I'm
there's so many different perspectives.
I'm more interested in our country.
Well, I think a pretty good rule of thumb as a general founding ethos for the United States was supposedly the general founding ethos of the United States. Free trade with all, entangling alliances with none. But we're a couple hundred years on from that point, and entangling alliances aplenty abound. So within the framework of the system as it exists now, I guess you can be trying to angle for a better, you know, national situation by getting this person on board with that agenda and getting that country into this entangling alliance. But the real solution to all of this, of course, would be to get rid of the system as it exists and all of these entangling alliances. Yeah. But, you know, that would involve actually rooting out the oligarchy, which is a lot easier said than done.
You know, there was a new study showing the growing polarization in America. And, you know, we see these bitter debates that were once combined to congressional hearings, and cable TV have now found their way into every part of our lives. There was a study done by More in Common. And it showed that about 8% of Americans in the hard left camp are well-educated, all voting, all giving money and time campaigns. Combined voices dominate Democratic policies. Then you have about 6% in the hard right. And, you know, just ditto from the Democrats. So it's no surprise to see this, division. And, you know, personally, I view it as all basically propaganda and distractions. But does the U.S. ever get out of this jam? Do you think that the U.S. will ever get back? And how do we get back to a government of by and for the people and not just these two extremes?
Yeah, well, or do I mean, we? First of all, I would say there was never a government by and for the people, and you could go back to the Whiskey Rebellion to show that, you know, even the Founding Fathers' generation was the same types of struggles. It's just magnified by a million by now. But I understand there was a relative freedom that existed back then that I suppose people might want to return to. But that's, I don't think returning to past times is ever really possible, given that where we've ended up now. So the question is, how do you actually get more freedom? The answer is not going to come from voting for this or that candidate within the controlled system, as I hope should be apparent to most of the listeners of this audience by now. But unfortunately, this is not just a system that developed by happenstance, or if it did, at any rate, it's participating in some sort of, you know, Darwinian evolutionary process whereby it continues to refine and get reformed into a more and more sleek and streamlined psychological conditioning tool that plays on people's most fundamental psychological proclivities. And we see that reflected everywhere, from the red and blue and left and right and choose a team and all of this. It gets people so divided and conquered. And we've talked about that a lot, and I'm afraid we're probably going to be talking about it a lot more in the future.
I hear the music. We're heading into a break, and we'll be right back in just a few moments. I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm here with James Corbett. Tell me if
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. And I'm here with James Corbett. And James, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about your, I believe, last week. I believe you wrote about a new report coming from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change titled Special Report on Global Warming of 1.5. And I want to combine two questions. Is there a difference between global warming and climate change? And you also wrote that this is a sure sign as any that the propagandists of the global warming fear cult and their corporate banksters, globalist backers, have succeeded in the most successful brainwashing campaign in the history of humanity.
Let's bite off and chew that in a few minutes, shall we?
Please continue.
All right. Well, on the former point, I guess one, if we were being very technical and very scientific, we could say, well, yes, global warming is a subset of climate change, but then there's the question of, well, what causes climate change? So then you have to talk about and differentiate natural climate variability from anthropogenic climate change and on and on and on. And you'll see why these terms just get kind of thrown around and smeared on the wall so that they all become the same thing, so that we don't have to think too deeply about them, because, of course, it isn't about the actual scientific technical information that is supposedly being conveyed by this intergovernmental emphasis on governmental panel on climate change. Because if people actually bother to go and read this new, quote-unquote, new report, which actually doesn't say very much that's new, the general gist and takeaway is, oh my God, we have until 2030 to basically start the drastic change towards mid-century. We need to have net zero carbon emissions, as they call them, even though, of course, we're talking specifically about carbon dioxide, which is a life-giving gas and extremely important for the health of the planet. And, of course, in commercial greenhouses, crops are often pumped with as much as 1,000 parts per million of carbon dioxide in order to ensure greater yields. Right now, we're at 400, a relatively carbon dioxide-starved level of the atmosphere. But, of course, we're expected to simply believe and swallow wholesale this scientific fraud that carbon dioxide is literally the global thermostat, and we can dial up and dial down the overall global average temperature of the planet by tenths of a degree, depending on how much carbon dioxide we are emitting into the atmosphere. It is bunk. It is total nonsense. And I've talked about this over and over, over the course of the past decade. There's many, many different pieces that I've done. I think a good starting point might be my question on my video on what is the global average temperature? Because that seems like a pretty basic question that should have a very straightforward answer, but spoiler, it doesn't. It's actually an extremely complicated question. It is not something that you can get from direct measurement, so it has to be calculated, and that calculation has all sorts of problems with it. And that's just the basis of what we need to determine in order to figure out, well, how much global warming is happening. And then we have to sort out natural variability from anthropogenic sources. So, I mean, you can go into layer after layer after layer after layer of the scientific and technical details, but here's the real takeaway. The interesting thing about the IPCC that no one really talks about, but is right there in your face, is that the IPCC releases these assessment reports usually once every 5 years, and they're heralded as the climate Bible. This is the compendium. 4,000 climate scientists and specialists get together and they find the consensus on what the science tells us, blah, 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 which again is all a lie. Look into the work of journalist Donna Lefram-Boise, who wrote about how it's literal, you know, grad students who don't even have a PhD and literal environmental activists are some of the authors, lead authors of these reports. And, it's, again, just total fraud. But we're expected to believe these IPCC assessment reports are the state of the science. But here's the little thing that they admit, if you go and actually look for this, they will admit it. The IPCC's documents are politically negotiated texts. And you can find that even with this latest special report on global warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius that they're talking about. That was a politically negotiated document where, since January, the diplomats at the UN, not the scientists, the diplomats have been negotiating the text that will be the summary for policymakers of this document. And then, once they find the political solution, they agree politically on this summary for policymakers, then they hand that back to the scientists and go, okay, now make your report agree with this summary that we've negotiated. Literally, the scientists change their technical assessment based on that politically negotiated document. And this isn't conspiracy theory. You can go to the actual IPCC website, and it's one of the sections of this report, changes made to this document as a result of the summary for policymakers, in to make the assessment in line with the summary for policymakers, whatever precise verbiage they use. They admit this is a politically negotiated text. So what is the real takeaway of this? It's not about the science. And again, there's a million things we could get into with regarding to the science, but no one really wants that. They all say, oh, you know, stick to the science, James, you're not a scientist, blah, blah, blah. But no one really wants to look at the science. It ultimately goes towards, well, skip to the end, what is the takeaway from this? And the takeaway is exactly what we see covered all over the mainstream media. Every single time the IPCC releases one of these reports, it's, oh no, we have 10 years left to save the planet. How do we do that? Carbon taxes and or cap and trade. It always comes back to that. And as I show in my latest video on the website, surprise, surprise, that's the New York Times takeaway from this latest IPCC report. The UN is telling us that we only have 10 years left to save the planet, so let's get carbon taxes and cap and trade. And as I go into in great detail in my documentary, Why Big Oil Conquered the World, I want people to know that this entire idea of carbon dioxide being the global thermostat has been hardwired into the big green, big environmental movement, which itself was founded and funded into existence by the same oil barons and oil families that these people are supposedly going against. And all of that is on the record, and I document it quite thoroughly in my documentary. But the point of this is ultimately towards carbon rationing, carbon eugenics. For the millionaires and the billionaires, they will have no problem. They'll be able to fly around and have their private jets and their private islands. But for the average person, it's going to be a dwindling standard of living. And it's all going to be for the sake of the earth and to protect the greenery of nature, which of course plays on our most fundamental human instincts. We all do care about nature. We do want a nice earth. We do not want to cause pollution and other things that are going to harm our natural environment. So they play on that to make you believe that it's all because you drive an SUV that the earth is going to hell in a handbasket. It has nothing to do with these international corporations or the military-industrial complex or all these other engines of global hegemony that are the drivers of global pollution. No, it's you and the fact that you have too many children and you breathe too much and you eat too much meat and all of these things that are now coming into the crosshairs. And this is part of the transformation of the entire global society, which they admit is the game plan for this. They talk about this openly, even in this the UNFCCC's press release about this IPCC report. They talk openly. The only way to achieve this is a total global transformation of society, all levels of society. They want to transform the economy so that they will have even greater control, and you and I will have even less to spend at the bottom levels of the ladder, and ultimately we will be like medieval peasants looking up at the lords and living in their castles on the hill. That will be the equivalent that the elite at least want to steer us into. And it should be obvious by this point, this is where this is going, and I just hope there are enough people out there who have retained enough critical thinking, critical faculties, that they can see that bigger picture and not get swept away by the hype.
I'm not sure it is obvious to these people. You try to talk to someone and just do some critical thinking with someone else that believes in this, you know, propaganda, this global warming, and I mean, they become unglued, and you know, it cracks me up. You see these people, well, I'm going to go get a little battery automobile because I'm doing my part in yeah. in fighting global warming.
And where does the energy for that battery come from, anyway?
I know. Yeah. And it's like you're so spot on. It's always the people's fault. It's our fault. And just like you said, you know, look around you. What do our little vehicles and our little lawnmowers do to promote any type of excess carbon dioxide that would affect?
And yet you have millions of people dying every year of either cold conditions that they're too cold. Literally, you had a death wave happening in Britain a few years ago where literally you had people freezing to death in their own homes because they couldn't afford their electricity bills. That's got to tell you something. But even broader in terms of the developing world and people who are not yet industrialized and accustomed to the standard of living we have here in the developed world, people who literally are dying from the smoke from their fires that they use to try to heat their homes and things like this. I mean, these are real problems that people really have that we take so much for granted. Oh, we're going to go back to that, you know, that subsistence lifestyle because, oh, won't it be so much better? We'll be more in tune with nature. Meanwhile, millions of people across the globe are dying annually from preventable things that we could do something about today, but, oh, we have to be scared of, you know, an inch of sea level rise 50 years from now. It's nonsensical on its face, but I'm almost convinced it's not meant to be sensical. It just plays on people's intuitions and their feelings so that it never actually engages their intellect. And it's interesting to me, when I started this website 11 years ago now, I expected a lot of pushback because at the time I was just on the cusp of when things like 9/11 truth and these types of ideas were becoming more acceptable to broach in public, but there was still a bit of pushback, and I was expecting that my website would get a lot of pushback and there would be a lot of arguments and, oh, you know, you're crazy, you think, you know, the US government had something to do with 9/11, oh, you're insane. I expect a lot of that. I received remarkably little pushback on those types of topics, but I still to this day receive by far the largest amount of pushback on the climate change subject, even from people who are perfectly happy and willing to say, oh yeah, they helped stage 9/11 and killed 3,000 Americans and started wars in the Middle East that killed a million people, and they'll slaughter whatever for their geopolitical aims and monetary ends, but lie about climate change, never. I mean, it's mind-boggling.
It is mind-boggling. And you know, every time there is some sort of a catastrophic weather event, they always attach global warming to it. Well, the storm is much bigger, more powerful. Because of the water is a degree warmer. You know, and they attach those storms. And I don't know if they do around the world, but they do here with every hurricane. You name it, every major snowstorm, they'll somehow attach global warming to it.
Yes, and I did a video on that a couple of years ago called Weather Is Not Climate that people should check. Yes. Because, of course, that's the thing that we always hear when it's a cold winter. So people say, oh, you know, global warming must not be here. And the climate cultists will say, well, weather isn't climate. This is just one winter. It doesn't mean anything. We have to look at the big scale. But it's the exact opposite. Whenever there's a heat wave or whenever there's a hurricane or something along those lines, then it's climate change. Look, here it is. But I did a piece breaking that down, and all of the hype and lies that surround that, the fact that tropical cyclones are decreasing in intensity and frequency, and hurricanes, droughts have reached record levels in recent years, except for the last couple of years, obviously. The heat waves, the forest fires, all of these different metrics are actually decreasing, but you wouldn't know that from watching the news.
No, you wouldn't. Do you believe governments manipulate the weather?
I yes. I mean, we know that they do.
We
at
do.
Least because they've talked about, I believe it was called Operation Popeye, which was trying to seed storms back in the Vietnam War to flood the Ho Chi Minh Trail and other things like that. We know that that technology exists, and that was 50 years ago.
Right.
So do we really believe that it stopped and ended there? No. I mean, we also know from things like the 2008 Beijing Olympics, where China openly talked about how they were going to seed clouds and do other things to make sure that it didn't rain on their parade, literally. So we know that these types of manipulations happen, but what is the extent of it, and how advanced is it? Obviously, it makes use of these ionospheric heaters, the most famous one of which was HARP, but that was only one in a vast worldwide network of ionospheric heaters, the real implications and powers of which we can only vaguely speculate about from the outside. So yes, clearly governments do have weather modification technologies, but the extent of that and the extent to which it's used is, of course, covered under a lot of government secrecy.
Real quick, you know, we have elections coming up. I don't know if we have time or not, but according to Axios, a hostile actor could just as much cause just as much chaos after the U.S. mid-elections by making it look like someone had meddled with votes than by actually doing so. Department of Homeland Security said that, and do you think this is something that's a possibility, or
Yes. Have
we had it in the past?
Yes, that's an extremely important point, but the real implication of that point is that we have to understand that just saying this vote has been tampered with is politically useful to the side that loses. So the very first people that we should be looking at as potentially involved in election tampering, or at least even casting the pall of election tampering, would have to be the losing side, exactly as we saw in 2016, when before the election happened, you had Trump saying, well, you know, these votes are rigged and I'm not going to trust them. And you had Hillary Clinton saying, that's an unbelievable, that's a shocking statement. How can anyone say that they don't believe in our democracy, blah, 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 and won't accept the results? This is unprecedented. And then after the election, exact opposite. Of course, Trump never mentions it again. And of course, Clinton and the Democrats go on this 2-year campaign about the Russian bots. So,
and probably a 3- and 4-year campaign. But anyway, I hear the music. And I want to thank you so much for joining me for the 40 minutes. And listeners, make sure you go to James's website, thecorbettreport.com. We'll be back on Monday. So until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
If I could be a wealthy man, I would not.